But the problem that we spent 1 hour with it was because the question wasn't precise. We didn't know what media he uses, how he displays it, how he gets the media. At the end of it, we only got the information that he's playing files on his computer that were shot either by himself or either by somebody else. And those files are, of course, in different formats, so not going further in it, the most popular formats. And we don't know which format he used. It was JPEG, TEF, GIF, PNG on the RAW. And RAW is uncompressed, so when he mentioned about uncompressed files, I assumed that those files were RAW files, RAW format files. Let me jump. But the bottom line is that he wants to have a high-quality picture. And a high-quality picture means shooting the files in the right high-quality camera with high-quality format. So his major problem is, I want good picture. So make sure that you have a good picture shot on good camera. And at that point, I use number of cameras, but very inexpensive is the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 4K, which is $1,200. It's not a big deal. And you have a 4K, and you have a good compression format, which is Blackmagic RAW. And the RAW file is also an uncompressed living job. And then you take that RAW format, RAW file, put it to DaVinci Resolve, which is for free. You don't have to pay one single penny for it. It's a Hollywood software. Yes, it sounds crazy, but yes, it is. This is a Hollywood grade and used by Hollywood software. You have two versions, free version and version studio, which costs only $299. That's why I say Blackmagic is killing the market. It's absolutely destroying that community. So you spend $1,200 for the good camera. You shot it. You go to your free software, Blackmagic DaVinci Resolve, and you process it, and you get what you want. And your display, no matter what size, will show you 4K. Simple like that. And to here.
Okay, thank you, Wesley, and thank you, Craig, for helping in this question. And I hope, David, you heard a bunch of things to ruminate and think about, and try what you said you were going to try, and see how it works for you. And we wish you good luck. And, you know, you can always come back if you have any further questions on this subject.
One last comment?
Yes, certainly, Craig.
In the future, if you're going to shoot 4K video, you don't need to spend $1,000 on a camera, even though the quality, I'm sure, is great. You can shoot if the angle that can be modified works for you. A GoPro that shoots 4K is amazing. There are probably 30 TV shows right now that are shot on a 4K GoPro, a series of 4K GoPros, or parts of them, that you would think they're using $10,000 cameras. And a good example is this Jerry Seinfeld Comedians in Cars in Coffee. All 100% of the interior shots are shot on 4K GoPros, and you think they're Panavision. KB2C, get back to me.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Craig. Again, thanks to Wesley and David. Good luck. And if you have any further questions, you know where you can express them.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Craig. Thank you for all the good information. And it's all very useful. I just want to say that most of my work is on just pictures and narration and music and animation. Back to you.
Okay, very good, David. Thanks for participating tonight. I want to hopefully get to Bob. Bob put his name on the list. Bob, you said you had a question for the technical net. What's your question? Okay, I'll give it one more try. I understand that that was an hour ago and you could have stepped away, but in case you're still near the radio, Bob, WB2, please, what would your question be tonight?
Everybody went away, Crystal Wesley!
Okay, well, we'll hope that Bob comes back next week. Well, let me go directly to tonight's mailbag question. The question was from a listener of ours in Connecticut. She used to have a license, and she used to work for the ARRL technical group. She kind of let the license lapse for a while, but she told me that she's going to be, going and getting her license, get her license again. So hopefully at some point, although she is in Connecticut, so I don't know how good the signal travels. She says she can hear us. I don't know if she'll be able to capture the repeater. But let me talk for a second, and then I will tell you what Georgina asked me. Okay. Georgina wrote, Dick has mentioned the use of the compact antennas that hit the market recently. They are sort of like a jelly donut construction, which effectively makes a large capacitor used on the roof of your car. If I remember correctly, the inventor says they make use of the magnetic qualities of a radio frequency wave and have secured a patent for the compact antenna's construction. She goes on to me, I see a dummy load-like device that happens to radiate. You can communicate quite well sometimes on a dummy load, she remarked. Would you please tell us your opinion of these antennas regarding if you think the idea behind them is sound? So she's talking about a compact antenna. They were brought up about 7-8 months ago, I believe. There were some people on the UHF repeater who bought them and loved them. They think they work great. I'm just curious if anyone out there has a compact antenna and has any opinions before I go through my own little spiel. Okay, I will take that as a not quite at this time response. The compact antenna is a very interesting design, and as I mentioned, the people who used it say that it works. I tend to have a problem with the inventor of it and his presentation of it. It seems to be based on an article that was written as far back as 2003 by a guy by the name of Zining Chen. He labeled his article a broadband roam monopole. That was, again, back in 2003. And the inventor, Dr. Jack Nielsen, actually cites that paper in some of his patent applications. Although he tends to dismiss the fact that his is a much more compact design and somehow more revolutionary than Mr. Chen's, Dr. Chen's work. The weird thing about good old Dr. Jack Nielsen is he's always being titled as Dr. Jack Nielsen. You never see Jack Nielsen or Mr. Nielsen. It's always Dr. Jack Nielsen. And I'm always a little confused by that when the doctor honorific is kind of not what you would expect. Let me drop for a sec. I suspect in going back to this guy's history, he has a medical degree. He was a family, a general medicine practice in 2015, although he doesn't seem to have an active license anymore. And I can't get any kind of credentials of any kind of electrical engineering or physics degrees, so the doctor seems to be an actual MD, but they promote it all over the damn place. Also, curiously, he held a technician's license until only about 2018 when he finally upgraded to a general license. I mean, that doesn't really mean anything one way or the other, but just kind of curious. And he has some interesting, strange videos where he suggests all kinds of things that some of them make some sense to me and some of them don't make any sense to me. He talks about the antenna operating using what he calls spatial and polarization diversity. But I have a problem with spatial diversity for an object that's inherently, by its name, compact. So it has very little spatial dimension to it. Let me drop for a sec. But that isn't what really concerns me. What really concerns me is the kind of mumbo-jumbo he tends to do on these videos where he discusses how his antenna utilizes the magnetic half of electromagnetism much more efficiently than regular antennas do, which is sort of like saying you've designed a glove that can catch the heads and tails of pennies. As far as I know, with electrodynamics, magnetism and electrical fields are bound together. You either draw them both in or you don't draw them both in. So I don't know. I mean, people sort of used that with magnetic loops in the old days, but a lot of people disparage that and think that magnetic loops are just a variation of a short dipole. So he's promoting the fact that he revolutionized electromagnetic theory, that in some way the magnetic field is utilized more with his antenna design, and then he speaks about how it rotates in polarity somehow in line with the electric field, which it doesn't. Electric and magnetic fields are at 90 degrees, they're orthogonal, that's what they do. His antenna can't do anything else. So he reminds me a great deal, unfortunately, of Guy DeForest, who invented the Audion tube, the triode, the amplification vacuum tube that revolutionized our hobby entirely. Up until then, we had spark gap generators, and we had cohering detectors that were just pieces of iron filing. The problem with Lee DeForest is he was a tinkerer and he was an inventor, but he wasn't an engineer and he wasn't a physicist, and he didn't really know why the Audion tube worked. He just found out that it did and patented it, sold it, and sued everyone who improved upon it. And that includes Edwin Armstrong, who was a brilliant engineer who gave us FM modulation, super regenerative circuits, and super heterodyne circuits. And in a court case where it's recorded, Edwin Armstrong informs Lee DeForest of how Lee DeForest's Audion tube actually works. And Lee DeForest, at that time, didn't have a clue. So I think this is a novel, interesting design. I think that what's going on, let me drop for a sec. I think what's going on is we usually talk about horizontally polarized signals and vertically polarized signals, which suggest that our antennas solely operate as linear polarization. For the most part, that is not really true. All antennas are polarized elliptically. Now, ellipses have extremes. On one end of the spectrum, an extreme ellipse can look as very close to a straight line. On the other end of the extreme ellipse, it looks like a perfect circle. So I think what it is when we say that something is linearly polarized and horizontal or vertical, we really mean that it's almost linearly polarized. The cosine of 90 degrees is zero, so you wouldn't get anything. It's because it's non-linear that you get that it's a bit more visible. So I think polarization action. But that's my conception.
Roy, NY2H, you're very noisy.
Yeah, I see that on my machine here. I don't know why. Now it doesn't look noisy, so I think someone kind of didn't like the subject of antennas or something.
Last 3 words of yours were okay.
Okay, so hopefully most of it came across. The compact antenna is a rolled-up, shortened antenna. It's spirally wound with a dielectric material, and it seems to work for people who are using it. And I tend to think that one of the reasons why when you get into an obstruction in ticket sensing, you get better reception using it is because it doesn't have quite as clearly a vertical polarization orientation than a standard ground wave, quarter wave vertical does. So it works. I don't think Dr. Jack Nielsen quite explains it correctly. I don't know if it's salesmanship going on or exactly what, because I guess if you describe it as simply an elliptical antenna, it's not as sexy as if you tell people that it has a wondrous magical ability to interact with magnetic fields as well as electrical fields. So you get twice the signal reception, which there's no documentation of that at all. Anyway, that's my 2 cents worth with the compact antenna. If anyone has any experience with the compact antenna or wants to talk about the compact antenna, please give me a call sign. Certainly, Steve. If you can bring up your gain a little bit on your mic.
All right, we'll try it again. So I have two of them, and they work extraordinarily well for only something that's about 9 inches off the surface of the roof. I bought the dual band version and found it to have much better performance over a 3 foot antenna that I had on the roof before. It cost actually more money than it. But yeah, he doesn't quite explain it in a satisfactory manner, but I will tell you this, it does work, and I know several club members that have them, and they do love them. And just as an aside, Roy, Lee DeForest went to the Yale School of Engineering, and then in 1899, he did on a PhD in physics. Back to that.
Okay, Steve, I'll look it up. I'm sorry that I'm wrong, but there are documents from the court case where he pretty much didn't have a clue how Audion tubes worked. At first, they were putting the control grid on the outside of the tube. Then they finally figured out to put it on the inside of the tube, but they didn't quite think that a full vacuum was that terribly important. So up until other people kind of perfected the Audion tube, it wasn't really a reliable amplifier. It just didn't perform as well as it might have. So, you know, I'll look into whether he got a PhD, but still, Edwin Armstrong was an incredibly brilliant engineer. He invented a whole bunch of things. It's well documented that he knew how it worked, and Lee DeForest didn't. And I'm curious about how you found the best use of the antenna. It's my understanding that unlike most antennas, it doesn't really benefit from placing it in the central area of the car as a ground sheet. It tends to have a higher vis-y if you do that, and it tends to operate better if you place it on one of the edges where the ground sheet is almost going vertical, you know, either the bumper in the back or the bumper in the front or the side. So have you noticed anything like that?
DR with a quick question?
Yeah, sure, Nick. One second. I just want to know if Steve heard me and he has any opinion about the placement of the compact antenna as far as he's experienced it.
Sorry about that. Yes, absolutely. It works much better in one of the four corners of the car. And he even says that in his instructions to do that. we did a test. Actually, Dick and I did a test. I had a trip out into central New Jersey. And we did a continuous communication test back and forth. Unfortunately, we didn't have the other antenna to compare it to, but I know full well that I could not have reached back to Dick's tall antenna with the previous antenna that I was using. And we did with that antenna, and it worked very, very well. And on the subject of inventors, subsequent inventors always improve on the original pioneer. With that, I'm going to say 73. The antenna is great. I use it. I can't explain it either, but it does work.
Question to that.
One sec, Wesley. Well, thanks, Steve. I appreciate you participating. I knew that you had experimented with it and you had discussed it on the UHF repeaters, and glad you were able to drop by. I agree with just from what I've heard from other people that it is actually a very effective design. I think it's intriguing. I would love to see a bunch of people kind of figure it out a little bit better than is available on YouTube and videos of its inventor. That's all that I wanted to have people take away from this discussion. Wesley, before we get to you, Nick, do you have a question about this or a different question entirely?
WB2CQT. Does it have a name and a so I could look it up and see maybe purchase one?
Yes, it does, Nick. Matter of fact, if you go to my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, among other things, it has a link to the Compact Antenna's own website. You will find that it's being sold at pretty much all of the usual suspects, ham radio company, retail distributors, HRO, I think, and DX Engineering, and unfortunately I'm blocking on the other ones that definitely, they're probably, you know, name a ham radio major store and just do a query and you'll come out with it. They're called Compact Antennas.
All right, QSL. I usually use HRO anyway. I'll look on that or Gigapods. Okay, very good.
WB2CQT.
CQT.
Yes, I tuned in a little late, but if you're talking about a thing that looks like a large hockey puck mounted on the flat surface of a car, I've seen them very frequently on unmarked law enforcement vehicles around the city. A higher end Ford automobile. It looks like a regular car, but if you know what to look for, you'll see that mounted in the middle of the trunk, and then you know it's some kind of a cop. Go ahead.
Well, it may not be the exact same antenna that we're talking about, but it might be a really close relative. The inventor of the compact antenna, Dr. Jack Nielsen, also used to work for a company called MP Antenna that sold the same sort of outward silhouette It was not optimized though for amateur radio use. It was it had different designs that were Wi-Fi and other frequencies. So it's very possible that this isn't exactly a compact antenna, but it's based on kind of the same concept. And it may be produced by mpantenna.com.
Okay, the ones I see on the law enforcement vehicles, they're mounted right in the middle of the trunk, on the trunk. And they're black, round, you know, like a hockey puck, but larger. And there's no question that I've looked the cars over, and they are law enforcement cars. I'll be just standing by WB2CQT.
Okay, thanks a lot. Wesley, you wanted to say something on the subject.
Yes, some versions of that antenna have no antenna port per se. They have inductive coupler adapter instead of it. I wonder what is the connection to the antenna in this particular one.
I have on my link a link to their patent. They're not quite as detailed as I would like, but it seems by looking at the illustration that the center pin is connected to the element, which is a large rectangular flat sheet of metal that's then coated with a dielectric and wound up to kind of decrease its width, and then encased. And the other lead goes to the ground of the antenna.
Is it by any chance a concept of, I forgot the word, fractal antenna.
I would think not. Fractal antennas have much more complicated internal structures, whereas this appears to be a relatively simple a sheet of conductive metal that's rolled up.
Okay. Anyhow, you interested me with that. I'm going to take a look at, you say, ac2gs.com, and where is that link? I'm in your page.
You type in your web browser, Roy, my name Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, .ac2gs.com. It'll take you to my link page. On my link page is a list of Nielsen's patents that you can review at your leisure, the patent for this particular compact antenna, a YouTube video of him doing a curious interpretation of how it works, and for people who like old-time humor, there's something called an encabulator video that sounds unfortunately way more reminiscent of Dr. Nielsen's explanation of how his antenna sort of works. So it's a little bit for everyone. If you like humor, you got humor. If you want technology, you got technology. If you want patents, you got patents. So roy.ac2gs.com.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Wesley. Anyone else with any comments on this subject? Otherwise, I will turn to a novel thing. It is a medically based mailbag question tonight. Okay. I got an email earlier tonight from Jennifer, N2WIX. She wrote that she's interested, in my opinion, about treatment for ARDS or pneumonia caused by COVID-19. She mentioned that she watched the video, and that video is also up on my link page, roy.ac2gs. And she relates that the person in the video is recommending a threefold treatment, including ventilating people on their stomach. She asked, is this the way that people are being treated for this virus right now? If not, why would they not be treated in this position? And she also gave me a link to an article that was cited in the YouTube video. So let me drop for a second. So what Jennifer is alluding to is one of the major causes of death of the COVID-19 virus. In a small group of small percentage of people infected, it travels from an upper respiratory tract infection to a lower respiratory tract, either in pneumonia or something even worse. Sometimes people suffering from COVID-19 develop an overreaction in their immune system to the viral infection. And they call it, you might have heard someone mentioning something like a cytokine a cascade. What amounts to is the entire lung becomes attacked by your own immune system and produces a diffuse inflammatory process that disrupts the lung's ability to perfuse oxygen into your bloodstream. The fancy word for that is acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. And very often this is a problem that leads people being intubated on ventilators, and some of them don't make it off the ventilators. It puts so much stress on their body that their heart will fail, or some other organism will fail, or there's another complication, unfortunately, of COVID-19. So ARDS is one of the principal ways that people, unfortunately, get terribly ill and can die. ARDS can be treated a little bit differently than most other respiratory problems, and that's what Jennifer was alluding to. You can do a bunch of different things. You can adjust the respirator a little differently for ARDS, and you can also rotate the person into a prone position on their belly on the respirator, and that improves the perfusion from the respirator and lessens the chances of some portions of the lungs collapsing. Let me drop for a sec. So her question basically was, does everyone get this treatment? And unfortunately, like most of the cases, no, everyone does. It depends upon the hospital. It depends upon the respiratory therapist and the pulmonologist. If they feel they're treating ARDS, most likely they are going to use these techniques. The rotating into the prone position was written up 10 years ago and is well understood by most pulmonologists. If they feel that this is just a purely viral pneumonia, they may decide not to implement the specific things that you do for ARDS. So in most cases, I would think that they use these methods to improve the chance of recovery. But in some situations where it might not be feasible because it's not quite that easy to put people on respirators in the prone position, it's not 100%. So hopefully Jennifer has heard my words, and I hope that you guys learned something from this as well.
KB2HHU?
SHHU.
Yeah, just a comment on the treatment for the prone position, et cetera. Just so you're aware, I arrived with an ambulance volunteer EMS, and at least in Nassau County, the protocol now, the advisory is that if someone's in severe respiratory distress, that we do try to place the patient in the prone position to accommodate this, if possible. So just, you know, something to note.
Hey, that's good to hear. Again, I unfortunately, nothing is 100% in this world, but Lou, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, so I think the other two elements, one was they use low tidal volume on the respirator. In other words, they're not pushing that much air into you because the lungs are so sensitive and they're kind of almost having a friction effect. So they want to diminish further damage to the lungs. But when they use low tidal volume, the patient feels like they're not getting enough air, so they're going to kind of fight it. So they give them a paralytic, and they paralyze them. So between the paralytic, the low tidal volume, and the prone position, I think that's the trifecta there, if I remember what I read recently.
Yes, Lou, that's the trifecta. I didn't want to complicate things by discussing tidal volumes with people. Paralytics can be effective. Unfortunately, that requires very good maintenance. You need a anesthetist, you need a pulmonary respiratory therapist, so that's a little bit more, you know, it depends upon the environment you're in. I would guess that if you were in an emergency room environment and everything was going crazy, you wouldn't go to that level. That's something probably primarily done in the intensive care units themselves, where they have staff that's able to deal with those things. But yeah, it's a trifecta. And that's treatment for ARDS, any form of ARDS. Even influenza in some cases can lead to acute respiratory distress syndrome.
Yeah. And because the health system is so overwhelmed, you know, I can imagine that you can't get top drawer right now. I mean, it's just overwhelmed, which is unfortunate. I would imagine Boris, what's his name over there, Johnson, probably got very intensive treatment. And, it's just not a luxury. You can't get that, because we're overwhelmed, unfortunately. And that's, I guess, one of the four criteria of getting back to normal is that they will not have an overwhelmed healthcare system, amongst other things. They want 14 days of declining problems, and there were two other things, probably the testing and the surveillance and tracking and that kind of thing. Anyway, it's my two cents. NY2H, back to net.
AC2GS, I agree with you entirely, Lou. There's a whole bunch of things. In order, if we're going to, quote, open up the country, you have to know where to open it and how much to open it. And in order for that, you need a number. You need to have much more testing available. Presently, I think the numbers are, in the United States, 100,000 tests are done a day. Most epidemiologists suggest that as a minimum 500,000 tests, and they would love to see a million tests. And in addition, they would like to have more people available to do these tests and correlate the data and supply the data in usable form. And also serology testing, which is hopefully coming on board soon. It unfortunately only has a 95 accuracy percent, so 1 in 20 is going to be wrong, at least at this point, from preliminary studies of the subject. So you have the social distancing. You can modulate it if you find that consistent screening and testing shows a low level of infection in certain areas, but you got to be able to modify it accordingly if the situation changes. So it's going to have to be a kind of intelligent strategy, not a gut feeling type of a thing. And the more data, the better. And the primary thing that we've kept on saying is flattening the curve. And what flattening the curve may not decrease the area under the curve, although hopefully it will, but it lowers the impact on health services so that the health services have enough employees, because those are important too, and supplies in order to properly treat people. If you completely overwhelm a healthcare facility, then you're not going to get optimum care, and the mortality rate will climb accordingly. So you want to keep the hospital use lower than threshold, and you want to screen people, and you want to have your eye on how the infections are throughout the country, because this is going to be an exercise in playing whack-a-mole. New York was the canary in the mine shaft. There will be others following us, unfortunately. So we have to know who's going when. Other questions? I have some COVID-related stories to share with you. Let me give you one of my stories on COVID. Let's see. As you no doubt know, some people are very confused and very panicky. There appear to be arson attacks against 5G masts in the United Kingdom. And they've grown serious enough that the carriers are actually joining together to put a stop to the incident. The four major companies in the United Kingdom have issued an actual joint statement urging people not to set fire to their cellular masts, or to threaten engineers, or to spread conspiracy theories falsely linking 5G to COVID-19. The network also encouraged people to report the abuse of engineers and to call out people spreading misinformation. As the companies reiterated, cell networks are critical in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. They provide essential connectivity to emergency services and the National Health Service. They help connect families and enable remote education. The arson has disrupted critical infrastructure, they say, of the carriers, and threats to the engineers have prevented essential network maintenance. Now, the statement will not only do so much to people who are already inclined to commit crimes. However, it comes as YouTube is pulling 5G-linked coronavirus conspiracy videos off, and as the United Kingdom Culture Secretary is planning to meet social media companies to curb the spread of these conspiracies. There's a concerted effort to set the record straight and prevent further attacks, and messages like this could help simply by underscoring the importance of that effort. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
N2HVR with a question on the subject.
Yes, Nick. Yes, Nick, what's your question?
Hello, Roy, and everyone can hear my voice. I hope you're safe and hanging in there. My question is this. I mean, this virus caught us, this country, and I guess every country in the world off guard. Do you think that possibly we're going to learn a lesson from almost 8,000 deaths in New York State alone, or I think in the city, that maybe we'll be prepared for something, you know, in the future? I'm wondering, you know, I would imagine that if there are some smart people in government, that they're going to take this, unfortunately, people have to die before we learn something usually, but take it as a good lesson and be prepared at least next time, you know, I heard that they're going to do some kind of monitoring, Google and some other people are looking into, like, actually monitoring, you know, a way of electronically monitoring viruses, maybe in the future, to help us prevent it. Because what the problem here in New York is that we weren't aware of what was going on before, and it was actually too late. By the time we closed the borders and shut down the airlines, there were so many people infected here, it was too late. Back to you, Roy, for your thoughts.
Yes, Nick. I would like to think that we will learn from our mistakes. Human history has demonstrated the tendency of that not to happen. It might happen to a degree in the short haul. In the long haul, memories fade and people pass away, and you know, you won't find anyone who remembers the great Spanish flu pandemic of 1917, 1920. And they made pretty much every single mistake that we made. And there are books explaining all of that. And people do free talk, but we keep making those mistakes. This is not our first pandemic. We've had swine flu, Ebola, we've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've had a whole bunch of things. So I desperately hope that we finally learned our lesson. But I kind of in the back of my head sort of know that people kind of after a while it fades away from memory and it's in a history book, so what does that mean? And it costs a lot to maintain a resource like ventilators. Ventilators go for anywhere from $4,000 to $40,000 a clip. So to have thousands of them and maintaining them and not using them, except when you need them once every century, most governments, unfortunately, will consider that a waste of their tax revenue. So I hope we learn from our mistakes, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Comment, and one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
Well, there's the not-so-distant past history of the SARS epidemic, where there was a call for U.S. surgical masks to be surgical masks to be made from a U.S. manufacturer, and the one and only company in the U.S. that was doing it promptly tooled up and expanded their output, and then immediately after this faded away, the federal government, which had promised to continue to buy from them to help keep them in business, reneged, and the VA promptly started buying masks from Mexico. So people don't remember within 24 months, let alone X number of years.
I agree with you. Unfortunately, people tend to have very short-sighted goals. If the problem isn't looming in front of you, you push it away and you leave it for the next administration. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me what happened. You know, some cultures, I perpetually am amazed with some cultures in medieval Europe. They started these enormous cathedrals knowing that they would not be finished in their lifetime or probably their children's lifetime, but maybe if they were lucky, their grandchildren's lifetime. And I couldn't begin to guess if anyone in this world is capable of that, of delaying satisfaction that much anymore. So I agree with you. We don't learn from our mistakes. We don't learn from history. We just don't learn. It's a shame. I think people have done great things through this terrible pandemic, but other people have done not so great things. Any other questions or comments on this particular subject? Otherwise, I'll move on to the next one. Okay, hopefully some of you will find this fascinating. New research indicates that the coronavirus actually began to circulate in the New York area by mid-February, weeks before the first confirmed case, and that travelers brought it in mainly from Europe, not Asia. Quote, the majority is clearly European, end quote, said Harm Van Beckel, a geneticist at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who co-wrote a study including peer review. A separate team at NYU Grossman School of Medicine came to striking similar conclusions. Despite studying a different group of cases, both teams analyzed genomes from coronaviruses taken from New Yorkers starting in mid-March. The research revealed a previously hidden spread of the virus that might have been detected if aggressive testing programs had been put in place. On January 31st, President Trump barred foreign nationals from entering the country if they had been in China during the prior 2 weeks. It would not be until late February that Italy would begin locking downtown cities, and March 11th when Mr. Trump said he would block travelers from most European countries. But New York has already been traveling home with the virus. Quote, people were just oblivious, end quote, said Adriana Hage, a member of the NYU team. Dr. Hage and Dr. Van Dackel belong to an international guild of viral historians. They ferret out the history of outbreaks by poring over clues embedded in the genetic material of viruses taken from thousands of patients. We drop the set. Viruses invade a cell and take over its molecular machinery, causing it to make new viruses. The process is quick and sloppy, and as a result, new viruses can gain a new mutation that wasn't present in their ancestors. If a new virus manages to escape its host and infect other people, its descendants will inherit that mutation. Tracking viral mutations demands sequencing of all the genetic material in a virus, its genome. Once researchers have gathered the genomes from a number of viral samples, they can compare their mutations. Sophisticated computer programs can then figure out how all these mutations arose as viruses descended from a common ancestor. If they get enough data, they can make rough estimates about how long ago these ancestors lived. That's because mutations arise at roughly regular pace, like a regular clock. Masij Boni of Penn State University and his colleagues recently used this method to see where the coronavirus designated SARS-CoV-2 came from in the first place. While conspiracy theories might falsely claim that the virus was concocted in a lab, the virus genome make clear that it arose in bats. There are many kinds of coronaviruses which infect both humans and animals. Dr. Boni and his colleagues found that the genome of the new virus contains a number of mutations in common with strains of coronaviruses that have been known to infect bats. Dr. Boni said that the ancestral virus probably gave rise to a number of strains that infected horseshoe bats and perhaps sometimes other animals. Quote, very likely there's a vast unsampled diversity, he said. Copying mistakes aren't the only way for new viruses to arise. Sometimes two kinds of coronaviruses will infect the same cell. Their genetic material then gets mixed up and forms into new viruses. It's entirely possible, Dr. Boni said, in the past 10 or 20 years, that a hybrid virus arose in some horseshoe bat that was well-suited to infect humans, but later that virus somehow finally managed to cross the species barrier. Quote, once in a while, one of these viruses wins the lottery, he said. In January, a team of Chinese and Australian researchers published the first genome of the new virus. Since then, researchers around the world have sequenced over 3,000 more. Some are genetically identical to each other, while others carry distinctive mutations. Let me drop for a sec. That's just a tiny sampling of the full diversity of the virus. As of April 8th, there were 1.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, and the true total is probably many millions more. But already the genomes of the virus are revealing previously hidden outlines of its history over the past few months. As the new genomes come to light, researchers upload them to an online database called GISAIDS. A team of virus evolution experts are analyzing the growing collection of genomes in a project called NextStrain. They continually update the virus family tree. These branches of the tree all belong to lineages from China. The NextStrain team has also used the mutation rate to determine that the virus probably first moved into humans from an animal host in late 2019. On December 31st, China announced that doctors in Wuhan were treating dozens of cases of a mysterious new respiratory illness. In January, as the scope of the catastrophe in China became clear, a few countries started an aggression program. They were able to track the arrival of the virus on their territory and track its spread through their population. But the United States sort of fumbled in making its first diagnostic kits and initially limited testing only to people who had come from China and displayed symptoms of COVID-19. A few cases came to light starting at the end of January, but it was easy to dismiss them as rare imports that did not lead to local outbreaks. The work was dashed at the end of February by Trevor Bedford, an associate professor at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and University of Washington, and its colleagues. Using NextStrain, they showed that the virus identified in a patient in late February had mutations shared by one identified in Washington on January 20th. Let me see for a sec. The Washington virus also shared other isolated in Wuhan, suggesting that a traveler had brought the coronavirus from China. With that discovery, Dr. Bedford and his colleagues took the lead in sequencing coronavirus genomes. Sequencing more genomes around Washington gave them a better view of how the outbreak there got started. Quote, "I'm quite confident that it was not spreading in December in the United States," Dr. Bedford said. There may have been a couple of other...
Might have our buddy back.
It's a shame he didn't burn out his final.
WP2AHK could be around 102 in Liberty again.
I got all night here. Still have all night here.